So our next talk is by Daniel Lambert on the impact of age, religion, and geographical location on social values and popular opinion. And so Daniel has a background in public health and health psychology with a focus on health disparities. She earned her MPH in behavioral health science and health education from Emory. She's worked on multiple federally funded grants focused on sexual risk reduction and health promotion, recently concentrating on evidence-based interventions for faith-based communities. Danielle is currently the co-PI of a study examining the role of upbringing and decision-making in the formation of social values. Danielle.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. So I'm going to be talking a little bit today about the impact of age, religion, and people's geographical location just within the U.S. and how that affects their opinions, specifically for this talk about reproductive health issues. I don't have anything to say. So echoing a little bit of what our other speakers have talked about, there is a lot of controversy going on about reproductive health issues in the U.S., so that's why this is a really important topic to look at further. People's upbringing and environment has been shown in the literature to influence the way that they think about reproductive health issues and how their environmental factors influence their decision-making. In particular, as related to this talk, literature also shows that your religion and the environment that you were raised in, if it was religious, can also influence your opinions about reproductive health issues and decision-making in general. So that was kind of the purpose of our study. We were trying to look at how upbringing, your social values, and your current stances on reproductive health issues were kind of all interrelated, and specifically how your age, your religious beliefs, your upbringing, and your location in the U.S. kind of affects the formation of these opinions. We also kind of wanted to see how our dissemination efforts of an electronic survey, how the reach and acceptability was received, specifically because we didn't offer any monetary incentive for participating in the study. So our recruitment, basically what we did is we contacted schools, churches, community organizations, basically any kind of established institution, and tried to elicit participation in this study. We asked them to either send out the study via email, post it to their Facebook. We really tried to use technology to our advantage and help snowball sample our study from there. So to date, we have contacted 86 academic institutions, 4 community-based organizations, and 527 churches, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second. And we did use Facebook and LinkedIn, which I'll talk about in a second, was really helpful. And the sample size that I'm going to be using for my presentation today is just a subset. It's the first 8 weeks of our data collection, which was from September to October of this year. So basically, we had a pretty broad inclusion criteria. We basically were wanting to get opinions from a wide variety of people who are currently living in the U.S. So you just have to be 18 or older, and we're hoping to expand into adolescence in the future, but just for the purposes of obtaining a informed consent, we just limited it to people who are 18 or older right now. And they just had to be currently living in the U.S. They didn't have to be born here, because we kind of wanted to see how opinions differ from people who moved here and then kind of were raised in the U.S., whether there was cultural differences once they moved here. You had to be able to access the internet because it was only the study was only done electronically. And we did require informed consent, but the signature was waived as we did not collect any personal information on the people who were participating in our study. So a little bit about recruitment, and again, this is just the first 8 weeks. Within the first 8 weeks, we had 1,025 people actually click on the link and view the study. From there, we had 791 people move on to the consent page and actually consent to be in the study. 271 people dropped out somewhere in the middle of the study and did not complete the entire survey. 10 were disqualified based on answers that they previously had. So they either consented and then later answered something that showed they either were 18 or they weren't currently living in the U.S., so we had to disqualify them. So the sample size that I'm going to be using for this presentation is 510, which was about a 65% response rate, which is pretty good considering the literature that surrounds electronic surveys, especially because we didn't offer a monetary incentive. So kind of thinking back on the number of institutions that we contacted during this time, basically, in an ideal world, if every single institution had participated, we're talking about two people per institution. So we kind of shifted our recruitment efforts after the first 8 weeks because just doing our first initial contact via email isn't being very effective. It's not gaining enough engagement from the places that we're reaching out to. They're not invested in this type of research, but just a cold email saying, hi, please participate, this is really important. So we've kind of moved more to calling and making in-person contact to kind of garner more involvement in the study. So looking a little bit at where our recruitment sources came from, I just want to point out a couple of interesting things from this slide. So the first thing I want to point out is the church and religious organization involvement. So I said we contacted 527 churches, but only 7.4% of our people came from churches. So you can kind of see that that was not really an effective way. We had to seriously oversample to get some sort of response from churches. They weren't really interested in being involved in this type of research. And it could go kind of back to the idea of stigmatized. We're asking about reproductive health issues. We're asking about sexual risk taking. And a lot of churches were just kind of like, no thanks, but good luck. So that was interesting. And then I really want to point out the use of technology. We had over half of our sample come just from Facebook and LinkedIn, and that was basically just not, it could have been places that posted on social media, but it was also just from like home institutions that we used who posted on their media, and then people shared it, and other people shared it. So just really emphasizing how easy technology can be in the future for recruitment. It takes a lot of the burden off of your own recruiters. And then the last thing I want to point out is the other. We had a lot of people click other. What I thought was interesting is most of those people wrote in LinkedIn, so the amount of people who didn't consider LinkedIn to be a social media was kind of interesting to me. And that might just be because it was a lot of older people, and they kind of consider that more as like a networking device instead of a social media like Facebook. So it's kind of interesting. So basically, our data collection was, we used an electronic survey software, Survey Gizmo. It was completely anonymous. It was a one-time cross-sectional survey. There was a lot of different measures that were included as part of the survey, but for the purposes of this presentation, I'm only going to be talking about beliefs about sexual education, abortion, and over-the-counter birth control pills. And the survey was intended to take about 20 minutes. Took less or longer depending on how tech savvy and computer knowledgeable you are. And we didn't offer any incentives, so there was no monetary payment for participating in the study. So I'm going to spend most of the time on the results section because I think this is where a lot of the interesting stuff comes from. So overall, the average age of people who participated over the first 8 weeks was about 39 years old. We had people who were 18 all the way up to 76. However, the majority of the people who participated were largely female, largely heterosexual, and largely born in the U.S. We did have every ethnic group in the U.S. represented except Pacific Islander, so that was the one thing that we were kind of missing. And some other interesting demographics to mention is that at the time that they took the survey, 72% of the people were in a relationship, 92% had engaged in some type of sexual activity in their life, and 42% of the people were parents. And then again, largely educated, high-income people took the survey, which I'll talk a little bit about at the end of my presentation. So two-thirds of the people had a master's degree or higher, and two-thirds of the people made $50,000 or higher as a total household income. So I'll mention some more about that later. And then for geographical location, largely people from the South, so two-thirds of our sample came from the South, and that was based on the U.S. Census Bureau's definition of the four regions of the U.S. And then most of our sample came largely from five states, and that was Georgia, California, North Carolina, New York, and Florida. And so I just want to mention that Emory is located in the South, and so something that we found is that the farther away from the home institution the place was we were trying to get to participate, the harder it was to actually get buy-in. The closer they were in the South or to Emory, the easier people were and wanted to get involved. So just the time and effort it takes to kind of establish relationships if they don't really know where you're coming from, the closer you are to the home institution, the easier with, oh, Emory, yeah, sure, we'd love to participate. So, interestingly, kind of echoing what you were saying, the large majority of the people identified with a religion, so almost 76%, but what's interesting is that only 46% of people said that they were actively practicing or involved in a religious community. And the large percentage of people were Christian, and then the second highest percent were people who are unaffiliated or, for our purposes, non-religious, so they didn't believe in any type of God. They didn't associate with any religion at all. So now I'm just going to talk about stratify age, religious upbringing, religion, and geographical location within the context of sex education, abortion, and over-the-counter birth control, and their beliefs, how that affected their beliefs. So for sex education, you can see that the majority of people believed that comprehensive sex education was the best type of sex education, which is kind of to be expected, and then it kind of tapered off from there to abstinence plus and then abstinence only, and only 1.5% of people said that they have no opinion about this matter. And then at the bottom, we asked them, who would you prefer to talk with you about sex education? And the majority of people wanted either their parent, their school, or a doctor or health professional to speak with them about this. However, I do want to point out the church and the religious institute information, because it's kind of deceiving when you think about the fact that this graph includes people who identified as non-religious. So when you take those people out and look at the people who are actively involved in a church, if you just look at their responses to whether or not you want your church to be involved, 55% of people said that they would like their church to talk to them about sex education. So sex education by age was a significant deterrent of their opinions about sex education. So younger people were 18 to 35 for our purposes, and older people were 36 plus, and that was just a median split based on our data. So younger people preferred comprehensive sex education, and older people preferred more of an abstinence-based education. And then by age, parents, extended family, school, and church and religious institution differed based on whether you were younger or older. And again, it's kind of interesting because older people prefer their church to talk to them as compared to younger people. So sex education by religion was significant as well. So people who identified as Protestant or Catholic were more likely to want more of an abstinence-based education than people who were unaffiliated. And it's kind of interesting because no one who identified as unaffiliated wanted abstinence-only education. And then when looking at sex education by geographical location, it falls just outside the significance range. But again, I just want to point out, it's interesting if you look at it, East versus West, nobody in the West wanted abstinence-only education. When you look at the East side of the country, then more people wanted abstinence-only education. So looking at parental communication, almost 47% of the people had their parents speak with them about safe sex. And the average age the respondents had their parent talk to them was about 13. And the average age, just so you know, in comparison, that people engaged in sex was 18. But the majority of people only had their female parents speak with them, which I thought was kind of interesting. But thinking back that the majority of our sample was women, we took out all the women and just looked at males to see if that was different. And you can kind of see it goes up a little bit that the males spoke with their male sons. But what's interesting to me is when we asked who they would ideally want them to speak, there's almost a split between both parents and the male. So it's really important that we educate both parents on how to speak to their children about safe sex, because it's not just a gender-to-gender kind of issue. And then when we look at the respondents who were parents themselves and whether they had spoken to their children, 42% were parents and 65% of them had spoken with their child about sex. And what's interesting is that whether or not the parent identified with a religious group influenced whether or not they had spoken to their child about sex. So those people who identified with a religious group versus people who are non-religious were less likely to have spoken to their child about sex. But whether their parents were religious or whether they had grown up in a religious home had no influence on whether their parents had spoken to them about sex. So it's really kind of like an individual level thing. What they identify with influences whether they speak to their children, but what they've previously experienced had no effect on what they were doing. I'm going to kind of hurry because I'm running out of time. So for abortion, again, we asked under all circumstances, most, a few, never, was our categories for what their beliefs about abortion were. Most people thought it should be legal under any circumstances, and then it tapered down from there. And when we asked why, it also echoes the previous speaker's beliefs. Most of them were related to the health of the woman or the health of the baby is why abortion should always be legal. And abortion did significantly differ based on whether you were a younger or older adult. Younger adults favored more of a liberal view on abortion, but it did not differ at all based on where you lived in the U.S. It did differ just outside the significance based on whether you were religious or not. And this is a collapsed view of religion, so we just collapsed it for the purposes of space into whether or not you thought it was legal or illegal. But when we look at it across all the different types, any, a few, most, and then your religion, it was highly significant. So it just kind of shows that abortion is a really complex issue, and we can't just split it into legal versus illegal, because people's religious beliefs affect what types they think it should be. And then getting lastly to over-the-counter birth control, 56% of people thought that it should be available, and the most common reason was because it prevented unwanted pregnancies. It was not significant, again, based on where you lived, but it was significant based on your age. So younger people favored over-the-counter birth control. Older people favored that it should have restrictions on it. And I just want to point out that if you look at based on where you live, the West, again, had much liberal ideas versus the South that was kind of split 50-50 on whether or not it should be accessible. And again, religion did play a part in whether or not you thought it should be available over-the-counter. Protestants and Catholics were split 50-50, and if you look over all the way on the right at the unaffiliated, the people who had no religious beliefs were more likely to think that it should always be available over the counter. And then lastly, the upbringing, and I think this is really interesting, whether they were raised in a religious home and actively involved in a church when they were young, they were more likely to think that it should be available over the counter versus people who grew up in a religious home were 70% more likely to say. Where 70% of those people thought it shouldn't be available over the counter. So I'm running out of time, but basically I just want to point out that when you stratify by all of this, it kind of shows that we need to take into account people's age, where they live, what their religious beliefs are. When we're creating interventions and educating people, we can't just do the same type of education for everyone. And we just need to look at generational trends, because if you're talking to all types of people, you need to consider what you're telling them, because if you are not considering generational differences, they might automatically be shutting you out and not even listening to what you're trying to educate them about because they don't believe the same thing as you. And I just want to acknowledge everyone who helped us with this study. And also, we're still actively recruiting, so if you and your organization would be interested in finding out more about the study or sending it out within your organization, just let me know, and I'd be happy to get you the information. Thank you.
Thank you.